nomination process. Sam, I think you're going to lead this discussion or provide us with a presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sam Rauch. I'm the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Regulatory Programs, or the Deputy Director of the National Fisheries Service in Washington, D.C. And I'm my portfolio basically covers all the sustainable fishing actions that we take, NIMS takes around the country, and all the endangered species, protected resources actions, and including also the habitat conservation actions. The marine protected area, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute, is an important part of what we're doing to try to bring some organization to the variety of marine protected areas that we have across the country. And I'll get into that in a minute. We briefed the council chairs were briefed on this project this past year. And although the councils have had at various times over the life of this project been briefed, they're about to move forward and actually populate the list of marine protected areas, and we wanted council inputs, and so we've decided that it was best to go back to the councils again and give them a refresher briefing, and for those of you who have never seen it, an initial briefing on what this project is, what the goals are, what we're trying to get out of it, before we ask the councils for specific input on specific areas. So with that, here's the outline of the presentation. One is to define MPAs. There's all kinds of different marine managed sites out there. NOAA has within itself marine sanctuaries, National Estuarine Research Reserves, and all the various closures and protected areas that NOAA Fisheries has for fishing issues. Department of Interior has national parks and seashores, national wildlife refuges, and other things. There are 35 states, various commonwealths and territories also have their own system of areas that they deal with in the oceans, and there's a number of tribal and local government authorities that are out there. So first, a bit of terminology. Given all the various things that are out there in the ocean, and they're called various things, marine reserves, sanctuaries, recreation areas, refuges, other things that are already in place now to protect in some manner or to manage marine resources, in 2000, there is an advisory committee, a FACA, Federal Advisory Committee. George LaPointe sits on it. There is council representation on it, and a number of other people sit on it. They determined in 2000 that, to use a term called marine managed areas, a broad umbrella term, which is a subset. This is from the executive order that created the whole process. This is the definition. The term we will refer to as marine managed areas, which it must have legally defined boundaries, so there must be geographically limited in some sense. It must be marine, which could be within ocean or coastal waters. It must be reserved, but by that term, it must be established by or currently subject to site-specific regulations that are unique to that area and not to any other area. And it must have some protection characteristic, in which the regulations that apply to that area must have some increased protection for conservation purposes separate from things outside the boundaries. So if you're all those things, you meet the definition of a marine managed area, and those are the ones that we're looking at. They've been working, MPA framework committee that we have been working on these, and there's over 1,800 of these marine protected areas, marine managed areas in U.S. waters under all these various authorities. About one-third of the EEZ right now is managed in some manner that could arguably fit this definition. Most allow multiple uses, including fishing and other extractive kind of uses. They're protected for certain isolated activities or isolated reasons. A very few are actually no-take areas in which extractive uses are prohibited in total. But most allow some sort of managed uses. The federal programs manage most of the areas, but the number of sites are actually predominantly by states, which makes some sort of sense. The federal areas tend to be larger and managed as a unit. So why to have a system of marine protected areas? One is to clear up confusion over the various types and purposes and terms that are out there, to bring some, I don't know about rationalization, but at least identify all the various legal authorities that underlie these various areas. Many times they overlap. But I think the single most important reason is because there's a lack of coordination among the MPAs. There is a issues of scale that can be solved if the MPAs are communicating with each other, working together, particularly on research projects where they're in an area. You can have them all talking to each other. You could plan. It doesn't mean that any one MPA or any one entity that manages that MPA will have the veto over what happens in somebody else's MPA, but at least you'll understand what all the various purposes for these areas are, and they could engage in, and we would encourage, comprehensive planning of the various MPAs within an area. And to look at connectivity. Are the things that you do in one connected to something that you might do elsewhere in the region? So that was the underlying purpose for the national systems. It was created, this whole process was created by President Clinton in 2000 through an executive order which requires us to, we already saw the definition, it requires us to engage in a process of populating a list of the MMPAs and then encouraging some various things on it, a comprehensive system, encouraging coordination and stewardship of the MPAs. The current president endorsed that executive order in 2001, giving the lead of the project to both Commerce, NOAA, and Interior. We already talked about some of these things. The benefits of the national system to the MPAs themselves in terms of coordination and a mechanism to address issues that may be happening beyond their boundaries, to look at other things. It is a benefit to the nation in terms of looking at this on a larger scale, rather than each individual state having the same type of habitat protected. Maybe you can protect, if they're talking together, as they wouldn't cede their jurisdiction, but if they're at least talking together, they could achieve broader conservation objectives or management objectives. And to stakeholders, and I think this is also very important, it's a transparent process. This is done through there's a part of this, which is we have this series now, and we'll do a gap analysis, and I'll talk about that in a minute, in which you'll identify where are there needs for additional protected areas. And you do it through a public process led by the advisory committee, run through the agencies, and people understand why, when, and where there's a need to protect, and then understand why the choices are made to use a particular authority, whether it's state or federal, or a particular federal agency to take action, as opposed to what we might have seen in other contexts where there is a push, often in the dead of night with nobody knowing why or how, to create a marine managed area for purposes that the public haven't been a part of. And so this would be a way to come at this, not as in we want to have a marine managed area because we want to have a jewel in the crown and say we achieved something, but to look at it from the bottom up and say, what do we need to achieve? Do we need an area to do that? And if we need an area, what kind of area is it? Is it a sanctuary? Is it a fishing closure? Is it a monument? Is it a state activity? What is it that you need? And so it's a bottom-up approach to creating new marine managed areas as opposed to a top-down approach. So what will the system do? There are a number of conservation objectives, which we'll talk about in a minute. I've listed a number of them. Many of them are similar or coincide very well with what the Fishery Management Council is trying to do. Once it is established, we will try to generate a comparable set of information about these various MPAs, what their purposes are, what they're trying to get at. We'll look at regional coordination. We'll provide tools to enhance stewardship by and the larger the grouping is, the more easily it will be able to attract funds and resources to deal with issues. And as I said, that we will conduct these regional gap analyses to identify whether or not, and if so, what kinds of new MPAs might be required. An important point is that there's no new regulatory authority in this. This does not give anybody the ability to come in and change the existing purposes of any of these areas, or to add regulatory structure and say, just because you're on the list, you have to do new things now, and it has to be more onerous, or you have to try to conserve different things. Certainly that we will use these to encourage those kinds of activities if we see a broad need across a region to do something, but there's no authority in the executive order doing such a thing. All right, the criteria for entry into the national system. So first, it has to meet the definition of a marine managed area in MPA, which we talked about before. It has to be delimited in terms of geographic area. It has to be marine. It has to be reserved. And it has to be protection. And it also has to be lasting. I mean, this is particularly an issue with fishery management areas where closures may rotate. Those would not be marine managed areas. Where the closures are seasonal, those would not necessarily be marine managed areas unless the seasonal closure was long-term. So this is an important issue with fishery, whether a fishery closure would meet this definition. It has to be some sort of lasting area. It doesn't mean that it's permanent, because we can always take away, just because it's on the list doesn't mean that it can't be taken off the list. And this is particularly important. If a fishery management council area is put on the list, we've heard concerns that, well, now is it going to be difficult to get off the list? And the answer is no. It's put on the list by the fishery management council, or it was created by the Fishery Management Council for Magnuson Act reasons. For those same Magnuson Act reasons, you could take it off the list and open it up again. Just because it's on this list and it was permanent when you did it doesn't mean that it won't ever come off the list. That's not the kind of permanence we're talking about. It has to have some sort of management plan. And for the purposes of this council, that can be part of a broader fishery management plan. So it can be a closed area identified in the fishery management plan, managed to the objectives of the fishery management plan, but there has to be some sort of plan. That should not be a problem for any of the fishery management areas that we choose to put on there, if we choose to put any on there. It has to contribute to the conservation objectives, which I'll talk about in just a second. And there's additional criteria if it's purely to protect a cultural resource, like a shipwreck or something else. That's not, this council doesn't have to address that, but they are there for those kinds of areas that are localized, like around the monitor or other shipwrecks that we have out there where we have closed areas around them. So there are a number of goals. There are 21 objectives, but I've not listed them all. In order to be on this list, you have to be able to say you're doing one of these things, and they're called conservation objectives, but they're really conservation and management objectives. And this is one thing NOAA Fisheries wanted to be clear on in this whole process, is that when we're talking about conserving, we're not talking about setting aside a piece of habitat as a no-take reserve, but rather that they'll be managed for important goals, like we would manage habitat areas of particular concern, perhaps, or other kinds of things where there are unique restrictions applied to that area, but that doesn't mean that all extractive uses are denied. They're just managed, and they're managed differently than the surrounding area. A number of these goals, there's the National Heritage Goal, which is to protect the biological communities, ecosystems, processes, other things through ecosystem-based approaches to do things like protect reproduction areas, to protect habitat, critical habitat for threatened species, important geological features, to protect things that are linked to the life history and other kinds of things. The other goal that many of the fisheries areas around the country would meet is a sustainable production goal. You manage an area in order to ensure sustainable fishing opportunities, high priority fishing grounds. You protect those so that, and it may not be the actual grounds, but if you want to manage spawning areas, this would fit very nicely into this production goal where you're protecting foraging grounds or other areas to ensure sustainable overall production. It's something that we do around the country with our fishing activities. So here's the process when we get started, and they are rolling this out starting in November. Eligible sites are invited to nominate themselves if they want to, if they are constructed that way, or states can nominate their areas. Managing agencies will nominate sites. That's NOAA, DOI, other things. NOAA has made clear that before we nominate any individual site for a fisheries-related Magnuson Act site, we're going to seek council input on that specific site. That's not what I'm here to do today, but I'm here to lay out this process because we will soon be coming to this council with specific areas if we find them, any that meet the criteria and indicate these areas would meet the definition. What do you think? Should they be on this list or not? And if the council agrees it should be on this list, then we'll take public comments. Agencies will review the public comments, go back to the councils if need be, and get a further round if the public comments have warranted it, and then populate the list. If the councils have said no, it's still up to NOAA to decide what to put on the list. And NOAA may still decide to put it on the list anyway. I don't think that's likely to happen. But because it is a NOAA process, that is our priority. But our intent is to work with the councils to hopefully we can achieve a common understanding about whether a particular area should or should not be on the list. This is just an example, and that's hard to read up there, of some of the lists around the country, some of the areas that might or might not meet the initial definition. As I said, I'm not here today to seek any approval about whether any of these particular areas are on the list or not. But these are some initial ones that there has been a process to identify a number of areas which might meet the definition. And these are currently on the list of potential candidate sites for evaluation for nominating. And the two in the Northeast are Closed Area 1, Closed Area 2, Stellwagen Bank, Jeffrey's Ledge, Restricted Area. And there may be others. As I said, this is not a comprehensive list, nor am I seeking council approval of these particular items or rejection of these particular areas today. So here's the process in a little bit more detail, and we're at step one. NOAA will update the councils on the launch of the national system and the proposed nomination process. That's what I'm doing today. We have had for a year or so a proposed framework that would guide the overall national program. It's been out for comment. We put it back out for comment in June of this year. The councils, various councils, did provide comments. We expect to be issuing a final product to that, the final overall program framework, in November at the meeting of the MPA Advisory Committee. After that, the MPA Center, which is both Fisheries Service and Ocean Service people on it, will identify the potential eligible fishery sites that meet that definition and have a management plan. The Fisheries Service will determine which of those sites contribute to those objectives that I laid out before and develop a list of sites that will be nominated. Then we'll come back to the councils with specific sites in their region and say, these sites meet the definition. Should they be on the list? Should they not? Let's talk about that. Once we get the council input, we will submit the list of the nominated sites to the MPA Center. It will go out for public comment. We will submit our final nomination and the MPA Center, which we are co-leads on, will accept them into the national system. So that's how the fishery sites will go in there. I do expect that there will be a number of fishery sites that we will want to put on the list, but not everything that we do will obviously meet those definitions. Here's the time frame of where we are. The initial nomination process will start as soon as we issue the final framework document in November and run through the spring. We'll be aiming for a diverse level of governments and types of MPAs. It would be nice to have some Fisheries Service MPAs on that list. We will need the time, though, to consult with the councils on the individual ones in there. It will clearly include the ones that NOAA does for ESA or the Marine Mammal Act. Those type of closures that we've done for those, whether it includes fisheries, Magnuson Act fishery closures or management areas will depend on the level of involvement we've gotten with the councils on individual ones. Sometime next spring there will be the announcement that the system has been initially populated. It will be an ongoing list that will build over time. So there'll be rolling nominations. In the future, there will probably be an annual cycle, but until the system is populated, it will be a rolling nomination process. And at some point, once we've got the list populated, they're going to do the first gap analysis, which I've indicated. And that's going to happen on the West Coast, off the Pacific, so that we can look at the California current ecosystem and decide whether or not anything else is going to do there, going to do that. And that's the end of the presentation, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Sam. Paul Howard.
Thanks, Sam. I'm sure you're aware of the comments that our council had sent in, and they're behind the tab. And one of our council's biggest concerns is, one of them was that the MPA Center was only intended to assist regulatory agencies, not to supplant them, so to speak. So our biggest concern was, once something's labeled as an MPA, a couple things. One, who's going to do this conservation and gap analysis? The MPA Center will have nothing to do with that. It'll be the regulatory agency. Is that correct?
Well, the MPA Center only has like four people that work for it. So
it's
the burden on that will fall largely on the regulatory agencies that support that agenda. It'll fall on NOAA and DOI to structure that process, which won't happen until next year. So I can't say exactly how that's going to occur, but the federal agencies will be the leads on those.
So say, for instance, so this is our concern, that if the council supports, say, Closed Area 1 as being an MPA, then the regulatory agency, not the OMB Center, not the MPA Center, will be looking at that to identify any gaps in conservation or management of that Closed Area 1. So we're kind of concerned about that because, you know, whether or not we should support an MPA when we lose control over it, so to speak. All we get to do is comment on the gap. So that's a big concern. Another concern of ours is that we'd like some public hearings to get more than just, you know, if something's going to happen during this gap analysis or any identification. For instance, the Stillwagon Bank Sanctuary could be listed by NOS as an MPA. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then the sanctuary people, or NOS, would be looking at the sanctuary to see if there's any gaps in conservation. And one of the gaps they will identify, that they've identified in their plan, is fisheries management. So there's got to be some type of hearing so the public, so we're aware and the public's aware of every type of MPA look and gap and analysis, because it impacts everything, and we don't want to miss anything. And that was another one of our comments. So I'm very concerned that we made a lot of real structured comments on how, you know, we tend to lose a bit. We're not sure if we're going to lose control over our own management. We're already under tremendous timelines to address OI and conservation and everything. And if we want to change the boundary of an MPA, Closed Area 1, we don't want a layer of bureaucracy, and at the same time, we may want it to ensure that we get, do you see, it's a real dilemma for us here. And I don't see any of our concerns being addressed, certainly not with this presentation, but, you know, the final report framework might address some of our concerns.
Let me be clear. NOAA Fisheries' intent in this is to make sure that you do not have another level of bureaucracy if you wanted to change the boundary of an MPA. So that's something we want to get out of this as well. We do not want, if the council determines to change a boundary or to get rid of it entirely, to open up an area, that there be any additional bureaucratic step that you have to go through other than your normal Magnuson Act process that you would go through. I do think that the gap analysis, the whole point of it, the strength of it, is that it is a public process to do that. If it is not going to be a public process, then NOAA Fisheries is not interested in going through it. And so we are hopefully going to design it. It hasn't been designed yet, so I can't say exactly. The advisory committee is going to be have a large role in designing it, although the agencies will have to staff and carry it out. So we'll have to do that. But we do want it to be a public process, because that otherwise it just doesn't add anything more than what we are right now. I would envision that Stellwagen is going to try to be a part of this, as are all the marine sanctuaries, I would imagine that they are. The gap analysis is intended to look first at not what Stellwagen thinks is a need, but at is there a need to address fishing-related impacts or something else. I'm going to say mining-related impacts. Is there a particular habitat that is vulnerable to ocean drilling that has no current protection because it supports fisheries or it does other things? All right, so if there is, so that's the gap then. There is a vulnerable habitat out there that has no protection. Through the public process, which is run through the advisory committee and everything else, what are the tools that you would use? Is it sufficient to use a DOI, Minerals Management Service regulation to deal with it? Do you need a no-take area like a sanctuary or a monument to deal with it? So those are the kinds of public decisions that we hope we get out of these kind of things in the public debate, because otherwise we are into the very sort of scenario that you described, which is decisions on need are made without public input, and we don't want that. So that's what we think the strength of this is, and that's what we do hope to get out of it.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of questions and then a few comments. On the goals, I was looking at the goals. I saw a goal one and a goal three. The slide switched. I'm not sure if I saw a goal two. I don't remember seeing it.
I can't get back. There's no slide for goal two. There is a goal two. I don't have it in front of me. I don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, the thing that
I knew what it was, but I didn't bring it, and I can't remember. I was thinking about that earlier, and I can't remember what it was.
The goal. Goal one and goal two were purely biological, and dealt with the ecosystem, the biological components of the ecosystem. I saw nothing that dealt with anything other than the biological components. Also, I share Paul's concerns, and I have a couple of others as well. You described this as a bottom-up process, but it's initiated by National Marine Fisheries Service, and I'm wondering, does it have any sunset rules? Are there any rules that govern sunsetting an area?
So the two questions, the biological factors, I mean, they do talk about factor one, and here it is. Let me go back to it. So there's 21 goals. These are only a part of them. There's, I think, four goals in total. These were the ones that I picked out because they were interested. There are cultural objectives, so you could have cultural areas that are protected, shipwrecks and those kinds of things. This one is clearly biological. This one does talk about fishing grounds and those kinds of, and that is a reason why you would do this. Sustain and restore high quality fishing grounds that are important to the nation's social, economic, and cultural well-being. So this is the one that I would put most of our fishery management areas in, as we're doing these things to promote sustainable fishing, long-term optimal yield, other kinds of things like that. That is in part biological, but it is looking at protecting the fishing opportunities in industry, and that's why we've set a lot of our MPAs right now, and that's where this would go.
And also identical to what the councils already do.
Exactly. For federal,
yeah, exactly is right.
For federal waters, but not necessarily for state waters and for other areas. And so this is
we're calling this top bottom up rather. And NOAA can list these things against the council's advice. That's bottom up, I guess. And you'll seek the council input on the nomination process, but still can list these areas without council approval, in fact, against the council's wishes. So it appears to me that what it serves to do is that it reduces flexibility in management, for one thing. And then I believe you said that it wasn't regulatory. If it's not regulatory, then why have it? There are no sunset rules. It appears to me to be one more bit of BS to put into an FMP's an FMP which is already loaded with requirements, and this does nothing but duplicate the requirements that are already there. So my conclusion would be that what we have is one-third of the EEZ was what you said, that is an additional layer of bureaucracy is precisely what it is, and it's pointless. I fail to see what it accomplishes that isn't accomplished at the more local level by the councils in their normal activities. And I just don't see the point. It appears to me to be a basically politically motivated additional layer of bureaucracy laid on us when we already have trouble having enough time to form our FMPs. Unless there's something I don't see here, that's how it appears to me.
It should come as no surprise that these goals and objectives mirror what the council's goals and objectives are, because that's why we put them in there. This is a national system. The vast number of MPAs are managed not federally, but by states and localities, which don't necessarily meet these. But this is not intended to be regulatory. You can fault it for that, but it is not intended to have any regulatory activity. It is intended to be a list so that they can coordinate activities among various things, among various hours. It's in part so that you can identify, so that we can all know what these areas are, what their goals are. Are there achievements that we can make by looking at it region-wide, as opposed to looking at it on a specific area? To look at the objectives that have a federal MPA, any state MPAs, if there's money to go to the MPAs to do, you know, if we have eight MPAs managed by the federal government and four states that are all trying to protect a particular kind of foraging habitat, can we do a joint scientific research project in those areas? Can we funnel money to those areas to do joint kind of activities? It's not later. I'm not going to talk about whether it. So the goal is coordination. The goal is not regulation. And that's all I should say about that.
Anyone else on the council?
Yeah.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one sort of general question and one fairly specific question. Recently, the president made a revision to Executive Order 12962 and also signed an executive memo on somewhat the same subject on August 25th. Just for those who aren't familiar, these had to do with essentially recreational fishing in federal areas. And I guess my general question is: Does this impact any of the overall MPA, the system of MPAs, and how they get implemented? And the specific one is: I didn't see on the list there the Papahana Umokukia, and I'm not got a clue whether I pronounced it correctly or not, National Marine Monument. And would either one of these executive orders or executive memo have an impact on that one? Because that was established under the Antiquities Act, is my understanding.
Yeah, so that's the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands Monument, which is the big yellow area in the middle of the Pacific out there. And the executive order deals with recreational fishing and encourages sustainable uses, encourages us to ensure that we allow sustainable recreational fishing as a use in these areas. It doesn't apply to any existing MPAs for whatever reason. It's forward looking. So it wouldn't apply to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands Monument, which is what I call it because I can't say the other one. So it's only forward looking. We've looked at that, and in particular, is this going to be an added authority for fishery management activities? And we've talked with the president's office, and the answer to that is no. It doesn't for Magnuson Act-related closures do anything different than what the Magnuson Act says, which is recreational fishing is an important part of what we manage for, and we need to make sure we take that into consideration as we continue to develop. It doesn't mean that if an area needs to be closed completely for all uses, and some areas do need to be closed for all uses, that you would have to allow recreational fishing in anyway. But you need to those areas would be very small, and you know there is a process in the Magnuson Act to deal with that. But it does encourage us to take recreational fishing into account for the purposes of the fishery management actions of the Magnuson Act. I don't think it does anything different. For the purposes of these, of any new MPAs that we might create, I think it would require us, before you made a decision to create one that banned all uses, to look seriously at recreational fishing and whether that needed to be banned. And I think it sets a high bar. But it was just issued, and I don't know all the details of how it was worked out. I don't have it in front of me right now, but that's my understanding. And Mr. Chairman, I should say one thing about the sunset. As I said again, the MPA process does not itself sunset, but we envision that it'll be a continued review of these items. And as I said before, if the council chooses to take something off the list, it'll be taken off the list. And it's not a there should be no extra bureaucracy to do that.
I guess I'm a little confused, Sam. So the council can object to a place being listed. It can be listed, but then the council can choose to remove it from the list?
The council establishes a closed area. The council could choose to open that area to all fishing. At that point, there would be no need to have it on the list anymore. So, you know, that's the way the council could take it off the list. I understand, like many things, there is a discomfort when the council could take an action and NOAA fisheries could come and disagree with that action and implement it anyway. And we want to limit those kinds of activities, as we always do. We cannot forego our responsibility as a federal agency to have the ultimate decision-making capability. But we've committed to talking to the councils. I don't foresee a scenario in which the councils would object and no officials would put it on the list anyway. But that might happen, and I thought it would be important to mention that.
Thanks. Sally.
Yeah, I think it might be helpful to think about this more so in the context of the value that this has to the council and what the council is required to do as far as identification and protection of essential fish habitat. I see this as a cataloging of MPAs in the region, the obvious ones like the closed areas that Sam mentioned, but other places that we don't think about a lot that are in state waters, like refuges, coastal parks, whether they're state or national parks. I think that's something that's going to be really important, especially in phase two of the habitat amendment. So I guess I would ask, how do you see this process as far as it helping identification and protection of essential fish habitat that the council is required to do?
I don't see it having a regulatory role, but much like the council's already comment on other activities outside of the council's sphere that affect essential fish habitat. And this would be a way to coordinate with other managers. And to some extent it happens anyway, but this would be a coordinated national-led effort to look at other management authorities to try to get the council's goal on essential fish habitat protected. Some of the essential fish habitat does occur in areas subject to other people's jurisdiction. And so this would be another way in which the councils could go in and say, as you're doing the planning for whatever you're doing, you need to bear in mind that this is an important resource of concern, and we need to work to do that. I mean, ideally we would have larger coordinated efforts among all the states, among all the territories, to achieve the same sort of goals in New England waters, and we would jointly be working to the same thing. That's an ideal. I mean, there's a model in the Gulf of Mexico where we're trying to do that with the Gulf of Mexico Alliance, where the states get together and they talk about managing the common objectives. None of them see their jurisdiction, but they do try to work together on things. And there are some scenarios and some situations in which that joint grouping has been more powerful than each one acting individually, looking at their own isolated thing. I can't talk specifically about what the details of it might be here, but that's the overall goal is to do something like that, is to say, if there's a common objective that Maine and Massachusetts and the federal government all want to do, we can work together to do that. That by putting them on the list, by making sure everybody understands what is there, why they were nominated, what the goals are, that helps us down the road.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. Appreciate the presentation, a bit of a review of our previous presentation, but we have new council members, and this certainly is helpful. I've always liked the idea of the MPA Center, specifically coordination, not regulation, to be helpful to the councils and certainly to the states. A clearinghouse of sorts, have a library to which we can go, and I've used that library oftentimes to help me with my own work within my state relative to marine protected areas, areas that have specific forms of protection that are somewhat long-lasting, not eternal, but somewhat long-lasting. You know, this conversation and the questions we're asking you would be going a lot easier if the MPA Center had addressed the comments that we submitted, the council submitted back in May. I don't want to go over those comments and ask them to you directly because that would be unfair, but still, the council put a lot of time into these specific comments, asked a lot of good questions, sought clarifications that really are important for us to get. You know, some of the questions that are being asked now are kind of repetitive because they wouldn't be asked if these comments had already been addressed by the MPA Center. So just bear that in mind, that these comments really do need to be addressed in a meaningful way. Otherwise, credibility is damaged and our working relationship isn't as good as it should be. And it should be good. It should be a very good working relationship with you and your staff. I got a question about procedure that you've alluded to. And that is, let's say that the MPA Center believes that Closed Area 1, Closed Area 2, Stellwagen Bank, not the sanctuary itself, but the areas that you showed in the figure that would be possible MPAs in the eyes of the MPA Center. Let's say that you determine that, indeed, those areas should be MPAs. You come to the council and you say, this is what we would like, and the council says, well, we don't want that. All right. You think it should happen. I assume, therefore, and tell me where I've gone astray, I assume, therefore, that you would then initiate the public hearing process. You emphasize that that would be important, a public hearing process. We would then have those hearings sponsored by the MPA Center, and the MPA Center would then be obliged to describe to the public what exactly is being requested, what exactly is being proposed. So you would propose that those would be MPAs. My question to you would be, when you go to the public hearing, would you actually be proposing some specific measures for those areas? Would you be asking the public for comments as to what should happen within those areas? You mentioned, for example, that we might need no-take areas, and I can't recall exactly how you used that term when you mentioned it before. But anyways, I guess I need to get some clarification as to how this process would actually work. And then after the public hearings are held, then what's the next step? What does the MPA Center do? Especially if the council says we don't want it, but after public hearings you say it will be. How do you respond to public comments that will be aimed at you specifically, such as these MPAs that you're proposing should have within them no-take areas? How do you respond to that?
So let me be clear. The final framework document, the council commented on the proposed framework document, and we need to take the council's comments in the final document, which hasn't come out yet. So my hope and my belief is that in the final framework document, we will be very responsive to the council's comments. So I don't mean to downplay that. There is some, I think, confusion about this nomination process. At the moment, all we're doing is nominating existing sites that are already regulated by somebody for some purpose. We will not be in this process nominating or asking for any additional regulation or even suggesting that additional regulation might occur. This is the clearinghouse of the list of sites for coordination. In this situation, the councils have sites that, under the Magnuson Act, have been created for fishery management purposes that might meet the definition. In the scenario that you posit, which I don't think is likely, but it might happen, where despite the fact that it meets the definition, the council, for whatever reason, doesn't want it on the list, and NOAA Fisheries thinks it does, we would go out to the public for comments on that one, and we would not be arguing for any additional regulation or anything else, because that's not the stage. The public will give the comments, and we'll make final decisions, and NOAA Fisheries will have to ultimately concur in the placing of it on the list. The question I think you were getting at is, in the second stage, after you do a gap analysis and you find that there is an important habitat in some area that is not protected, what do you do about that? And so the first, the finding, that conclusion will be developed hopefully in a public process. That is our hope. We're working with the advisory committee, and George LaPointe, as it says, on that, to make sure that that is a public process and you get peer reviewed and all those other kinds of things. In that scenario, it'll say, for instance, it says there's a particularly unique kind of habitat that is not protected, but it's susceptible to fishing gear pressure. I don't know what that would be, but that, you know, say there that's the answer. Then it would seem to me that that process would lead to the question of what do you need to do to protect it. Well, if what you need to do to protect it is to decrease the fishing pressure or activity around that, then we would go through the council process to do it. And if the council says no, under the Magnuson Act, there won't be a closed area. You know, we go through the normal procedure. You could go through particularly a secretarial amendment or something like that, but it would be a Magnuson Act-driven procedure to decide whether or not to use the Magnuson Act to enact a Magnuson Act closure. And that's all that it would be. So it would create an impetus to that process, but it would not dictate or drive that process.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Okay, fine. That's a good clarification. So let's say then the gap analysis is done by the National Marine Fisheries Service, by NOAA Fisheries. They have to do it. I think you indicated that they would be the ones to do the analyses. All right, let's say they do that analysis and they determine that all of Jeffrey's Ledge, which is north of Stillwagon Bank, that all of Jeffrey's Ledge needs some additional protection. Okay, let's say that is concluded. Then I just wonder then what kind of a position does that put NOAA Fisheries in? Because if that's the kind of conclusion they reach, do they come to the council and say, well, now action must be taken in that area? And if the council says no, we do not intend to take action in that area, for example, close a portion of that area down, then what happens? Do we end up in a conflict situation with the National Marine Fisheries Service because now they've done this analysis that indicates certain things must be done, but we disagree? I'm just trying to follow this through to an end point. I'm trying to figure out how to avoid conflict.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that could happen now. I mean, this process aside, the Fisheries Service could decide that something needed to be done for whatever reason and would encourage the council to do that. I mean, we have done that in the past, and the councils have on occasion said no. And not done what we thought we wanted to do. And sometimes that's the end of the story. And sometimes the statute does give, in the right circumstance, the ability for the secretary to take other action. We don't like to do that. We don't want to do that. But that's there. And that could, you know, this process aside, that could always happen. And we try to minimize that by talking to the councils and reaching common understanding of that first. And I think that's what, you know, that's what the habitat committees are all about and other kinds of things. So I don't think that's going to happen, but it could always happen.
Dave Cathel.
Yeah. Hi, welcome to New England.
Were you here before lunch?
Yeah, I was here a little bit before.
Did you see the number of people that were here for Heron?
Yes.
Okay. So you get it. What I'm driving at is you get an idea that New England is a very public process-oriented region of the country. If people understood, if people knew you were going to give this presentation today and what the ramifications of it were, there'd be just as many of them sitting here right now, but they don't quite grasp all this yet. And there's a number of reasons for that. The first is that it was created by an executive order. It has had no public process. An executive order, to me, is the worst abuse of democratic process. You basically rule by fiat. You didn't put it through Congress. You didn't put it through any kind of governing body that's accountable to the people. You just did it. The president did it. Good for him. So we already have problems with the transparent process aspect of this. Now, when you go to your, it's the bubble chart here, the nomination process, right? At one time, wasn't the council in the second bubble instead of up above it with an arrow?
I don't know the history of this particular slide and what
okay.
it was, but...
Well, I mean, think
it's always been important to get the council input into this whole process.
Okay. Well, so in keeping with the transparent aspect of it, it would be a lot more transparent if the council was at that level, because the council is a public body and it takes public comment. Right now, if you put a managing agency in there, a managing agency is a bureaucratic body. It meets behind closed doors in secret. It doesn't have any interaction with the public at all. Or very little interaction. So that would be a suggestion. On the issue of the ones that you actually have listed as potential sites in New England, the council likes to move the bodies, the boundaries of these sites as it sees fit. We do a number of different things in these areas. We have habitat closures in them. We have ground fish closures. We have scallop rotational management openings and closings. We have herring fishing going on, and lobster fishing, slime eels, red crab, you name it. There's all kinds of stuff going on in all these places, at all different levels, in all different management plans. And anything that hinders us from being able to do with those areas as we see fit is going to be a real problem. Now, I know you said that it's not going to hinder us at all, but quite frankly, I'll put it as bluntly as I can, I don't believe it. And the last point I wanted to make is, again, back to the bubble thing here, managing agencies nominate sites. Since the council is not the managing agency there and it says agencies, it could be a number of different organizations. And in New England, we have constant pull with a number of agencies as to who's going to do what where. And there's a lot of people who would like to sneak things through the back door that they couldn't possibly get through the front. And I don't want to be in competition with other agencies to manage fish. And I'll be very blunt about it. It's Stellwagen Bank. When that was formed as a sanctuary 25-odd years ago, whatever it was, we were told point blank that there would be no restriction on fishing in that sanctuary. And ever since then, the people who have run the sanctuary have, to some degree or another, tried to find a way to throw the fishermen out, both recreational and commercial. And I'm very leery that this process could, again, succeed through the back door what they can't get through the front. That they come in, nominate it, say, oh, you got to stop fishing in here. It's harming the sanctuary. Council, sorry, you get to have a little input, but... You know, the public, you get to come to the microphone and say something, but in the end, this is what we're going to do. So I really hope you take this process back and rework it some and make it very clear who in fact manages fisheries and who can nominate things to be marine protected areas and who can't. Because otherwise, I think you're going to have a horrible clash of wills. That's probably going to result in people going to Congress at some point and saying, you've got to fix this whole mess. And I don't think that's going to be good for any of us.
I'll just clarify that
by managing agencies there on that slide, we mean the agency that is managing that particular site. So no one else other than NIMS and the councils can nominate a fishery management area as a site. We couldn't go in and nominate a state-managed area. The states would have to do that. The Sanctuaries Program can't come in and nominate Closed Area 1. They could nominate their sanctuary, but they couldn't nominate somebody else's.
Well, I'm going to have a couple more comments. I want to take a few from the audience, and then we're going to need to move on. So, Jim Fair.
Just to follow up on that last question, could the existing sanctuaries use this process to gain regulatory authority that they don't presently have?
No. There's no regulatory – the executive order couldn't create a regulatory authority that didn't previously exist. They cannot use this process to gain any regulatory authority. Mr. Gockel said is if through this process it is identified that there's a need for further action, they could use that as an impetus to go to their sanctuaries process and seek whatever changes they want to make. They could do that now. It's just another piece of information. So that's there. But there's no regulatory authority through this process that they could use.
Dave Preble, and then I'm going to go to the audience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, we're not sniping at you here. I don't want you to think we are, okay? There's some serious concerns. If this is a first level, you mentioned a first level and a second level. If the first level is to create a database, then I see some use to that. I don't see a real problem with that. But that doesn't appear to be what we have here. You mentioned a second level that would seek regulation. And then if you weren't able to get it that way, then you would go to see, you mentioned secretarial action. The problem with that is that right now we're putting an awful lot of time, an awful lot of money, and an awful lot of effort into an amendment, a habitat amendment, in which we are creating a vulnerability assessment matrix that is extraordinarily detailed, and it's being put together by the best people in the business. And I just don't see how you could come up with something that would come even close to equaling the ability of that to predict potential impact on ecosystems from Washington, D.C. And that's so, again, if it's going to be just a database sort of thing, then that's one issue. But if this is something that's – you know what? Let me ask a specific question. Closed Area 2, if that were declared a part of the MPA, and the council decided that in order to improve access to Haddock, that we wanted to open up a strip along the Hague line, on the west side of the Hague line, let's say 10 miles wide, to allow draggers to fish that area with selective gear in order to take Haddock. Would that be something that we could do simply and easily, or would we have to come back and run that through the MPA process?
You wouldn't have to run any of that through the MPA process. The MPA process would reflect whatever you did, and we would make whatever modifications we needed to make to the list. But you will take whatever fishery management action you need to take based under your decisions under the Magnuson Act, not in consultation with the MPA Center or anything like that.
Go to the audience. Alan?
I have a great deal of comments, and I'm going to try to keep them as succinct as possible. I am a member of the MPA FAC. I'm the fishing industry representative for New England. And I want you to know that the MPA FAC has 30 members. We are very, very diverse. And I've been on for 2 years, most of the white papers we've come up with, and we have come up with several, as you can see, most the first half of your presentation was from our white papers, they were done by consensus. A lot of debate, a lot of hard work, and it's been mind-boggling. That's the good part. The difficult part, I guess, has to do with the listing of the actual nominees. I was in an executive committee phone call last week, and we were told by the MPA Center that they were going to have a celebration at our November meeting to start the process of invitations. And for the past 2 years, every meeting, someone on the committee, what I'd like to say before I go any further is that I am not speaking for the committee today. I'm speaking as a New England resident, and I want you to realize that. I am going to take back everything that I heard today to the FAC at our November meeting. We were told that we would get a copy of the final list of invitees prior to it becoming public, and then the public would get it before the invitations went out. And when I asked about the list last week's conference call, I was told that it hadn't been finished yet. So one of my questions is, have you seen it yet? No. Okay. This concerns me. The council should see them, especially the fisheries ones, most definitely. Most of our white papers have had notes in them from the entire FAC saying that the council process is important and that the councils should have a major role in nomination. The last meeting I was at, I specifically asked if the National Marine Fisheries Service and the councils disagreed on the nomination of a site, what was going to happen. And I was told that they would not become an MPA of the national system. So I need to get some clarification from you on that. There were a couple other questions that came up, and Mr. Preble asked if there were any sunsetting rules. As of yet, we have not come up with any, and neither has the MPA Center. I was under the impression that the MPA Center was going to be doing the gap analysis. So this is new information to me that the agencies will be doing them. As at the moment, the MPA FAC is looking at, we've been discussing protocols for taking systems out of the MPAs, out of the national system. There are no protocols yet, and it concerns me that we would start inviting the process in without having the protocols together for the whole system for all most contingencies. We were told, and I definitely agree, that if the councils decided to open up an area that had been listed as part of the national system, that you could change the boundaries at any time. You just notify the national system that they had been changed, and that is exactly what you had said. We were also told at the last meeting that the MPA Center would not be holding public hearings, that it was up to the governing bodies, and for fisheries instances, it would be the councils. It's been brought up several times. The protocols for the public input have not been set forth, and it has concerned me right along. It's come up at every meeting. The words bottom-up and stakeholder input have come up over and over again several times at each meeting. The transparency is important. The entire FAC has agreed that in order for a national system of MPAs to work, It has to start from the bottom up. And the bottom up are the stakeholders have to say, this is a good idea. It can't come down as Moses from the mountain. And I know that, that's one of our priorities as a FAC, at least on my part. There are a whole lot of other issues. I have problems with a couple of the things on the handouts. I haven't seen, as David said, I've seen the nomination process on page 6 with the little bubbles, but since I saw this at our last meeting in April in D.C., the council input has been added to that, so I hadn't seen that. I was under the impression that the council was the second bubble with the National Marine Fisheries Service. So that's a little surprising. On the last page, under the National System Milestones, this concerns me. It says NOAA Fisheries Service needs time to consult with councils, but initial national system group could include MPAs established under MMPA and ESA. And this is new to me also. I need some clarification on what exactly that means and what process, what public process that would go through. And I really think that it would be important for the council to ask for the MPA Center and the National Marine Fisheries Service to put in writing the public process, because I feel like this is what has worried me the entire time I've been on the committee. And the committee, I need to tell you, the MPA Center staff and the committee have worked together very hard to get a program together and protocols together that will work. You know, the smallest possible protected areas for the biggest bang. And I would really hate to see this whole thing fall apart because we all can't get together and set up a structure that will work from the bottom up. Thank you.
Are there any other comments from the audience? Seeing none, thank you very much, Sam, for coming and taking all of the questions and giving the presentation.
Thank you.
We are going to move on to the next agenda item, which